This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do.
I would like to introduce you to Dr. Ferber Carr, who is an internationally known author, historian, scholar, Bible translator. He wears many, many, many hats. Today, though, he comes to us as the author of Germany's Black Holocaust from 1890 to 1945. Ferber Carr, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm happy to be a part of the program.
Well, let me start with asking you what is probably a question on the minds of many people who just heard me say Germany's Black Holocaust. We are used to people saying that the Holocaust did not happen. We're used to people saying it did happen, but it wasn't that bad. We're used to people saying the Holocaust was a wholesale slaughter of persons who were Jewish. We are not used to hearing anyone talk about black folks as being part of a Holocaust.
Well, the first thing I'd like to say about that is that it is a story that has not been told before, has not been brought to the world's attention, and I could certainly see why individuals are somewhat reticent or reluctant, I should say, to believe the story. But the fact of the matter is, there were individuals who were black Africans, who actually were the forerunners of victims of Germany's Holocaust. Now, I say Germany's Holocaust because Germany had two holocausts against black people.
Hmm.
Yes, which is really disturbing and unusual, but anyway, the first one was against various ethnic groups, black ethnic groups, black Africans, in what they called at the time German Southwest Africa. Today that's called Namibia.
Okay.
So Germany had a colony there when Europe was, of course, sponsoring, if you will, a number of colonies there in Africa. And what was particularly disturbing is that the Germans did some things that the Belgians had done in the Congo, but even worse, they put black people in concentration camps. They experimented on them, they being the Germans in German Southwest Africa.
Mm.
And they did pretty much everything they later did to the Jews some 30 or 40 years earlier, so that we can have the timeline correct in our minds. This happened in the late 1800s, early 1900s in particular. So when German conducted these atrocities against black people there in Africa, then they tried to suppress it. So that's the first Holocaust.
Okay.
Now, second Holocaust is the one that most people are familiar with, which happened in World War II. Well, you had black individuals who were also victims of Germany's Holocaust, and they were actually experimented on, these black men, for different reasons. But before I get to that, the question in some people's minds might be, well, where did these black people come from?
Right.
During World War II. Well, actually, you had during the period between World War I and World War II, in Heidelberg especially, you had a very nice cultural revolution, if you will.
Hmm.
The Germans had lost World War I. They were recovering, and in the process, their enemies, prior enemies, who were the French, they sent in their own black troops along the Rhineland. So now you have black troops from France, or one of France's colonies, actually policing the Rhineland and running Germany.
Huh. I don't think that's a piece of information that is out there in any degree.
That is correct. That is correct. My book proves that. I have documentation as well as photographs.
Yes.
Proving that you had black Africans running Germany. And in fact, that's what really gave rise to Hitler. It wasn't so much, let me become a powerful person and get Jews. No, the first thing on his agenda was, let me get rid of these black troops that are running our country.
Gotcha.
Because we have just lost the war, signed the Treaty of Versailles, and now black people and black men are running that country. And here's something else that's quite interesting, and that is, these black men were decked out, dressed very nicely in their uniforms, and the white German women went crazy over them. So there are so many nuances.
Yes, absolutely.
This whole thing.
Why would the French have specifically sent black African men to Germany? What's your thought about that?
Well, that's because they didn't think it to be a big thing.
Okay.
They weren't nearly as racist as some of the other European powers.
Okay.
And they, instead of sending their white troops, they're right there next to Germany, we'll just send our black troops in, you know. Let's just send individuals who are representing us, and they are malleable as far as they're taking orders and their personalities are concerned.
Okay.
But they had white commanders now. You had black troops, but few white commanders actually were in charge of all of these black French troops. So I want to keep that in mind. So they sent them in, and they, of course, had no way of knowing how the Germans would react. Now, in the German press, as is brought out in my book, you had stories that these black men were, and tell me if this sounds familiar to you, raping white women.
Yeah, that sounds awfully familiar.
Yes. And what happened was, it was just the other way around. And of course, they being the black troops, they were very nice. They were cordial. They were fair. So that means that if there was a altercation between two German men and they called the police, well, guess who showed up?
I gotcha. Okay.
The black troops, right? So they were the cops and everything. And it was a beautiful area along the Rhineland Valley. So, of course, where the river is, the Rhineland River, Rhine River, I should say. So it is, it's just a part of history that is never, ever talked about or seldom talked about at best. And that's why I brought my book out, and it has received rave reviews. Because of the information that has never been revealed to the public at large.
You know, I think back on my own bookshelf, and years ago, I came across a book, and I unfortunately do not know who wrote the book. But what struck me was the description of the first German lampshades. And the author said the first German lampshades were black skin. And that was the first time that I had ever heard, first and last time that I'd ever heard anything about blacks being in the Holocaust, that there being a Holocaust against black people, until I ran across your book some years back. Why do you think this is perhaps one of the better kept secrets in history?
Well, like so many other things dealing with black firsts or some outstanding contribution that blacks have made to history, it is, of course, put under the covers, as it were.
Mm.
Now, in the case of the Holocaust, unfortunately, the Jewish mindset, as far as scholars are concerned, is this: blacks own slavery, we own the Holocaust.
Yeah.
You know, and that's unfortunate, and it is something that smacks of, in a sense, discrimination. Like, okay, we know that didn't happen to the Jews. We know that millions of Jews were not taken from their homeland, and millions died in the transatlantic slave trade. We know that didn't happen. So when you look at what did happen to the Jews, unfortunately and regrettably, they don't want that story, at least some segments of the Jewish community. They don't want that story to eclipse, namely the story of blacks being the first victims. You know, and it's like, oh, okay, well, you know, we'll take this. Now, I'll tell you something else that you won't read likely anywhere else outside of my book. You mentioned the black skin lampshade. Mm-hmm. Of course, that happened to Jews later, right?
Right.
And as I stated, what happened to the Jews for the most part happened to blacks first.
Right.
You see, that just happened in a void. Like, okay, let's decide to torture Jews and experiment on them. No, Hitler's predecessors, the colonial Germans, had done that already in Africa. So that's where they got the idea from. Mm-hmm. Now, here's something that is rather startling, and to say the least, a little-known fact, and that is, yes, during Hitler's time, many people were experimented on. But he experimented on black men for reasons other than the ones he experimented on others, or white men.
Hmm.
Why is that? Well, Hitler was trying to, or what did he do specifically? Well, Hitler was trying to, shockingly, extract the melanin from the black skin of the soldiers so that he could, theoretically, inject them into his soldiers as he planned to take the colonies back. And once he injected these, at least all in theory, this melanin in the soldiers, the white soldiers, he thought that they would be able to deal with the heat, humidity, and disease better if he had the melanin from these black Africans. Now, that's a story that's not going to be told.
That's very true. That is stunning, and on so many levels.
Indeed.
So he was trying to improve his own soldiers by experimenting on black soldiers.
Absolutely, because he was intrigued with the fact that these blacks can deal with this heat, with the humidity, and with the disease there in Africa. That intrigued him. So he thought, my God, I need to have a super soldier. That's where they get the idea of all these super soldiers and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
They got a Hitler, you see, for the most part in our modern era. And so he realized long before the world did at large, if you will, or the other European powers, that, hey, I'm going to try to harness that energy, the talent, you know, the unusual prowess of the black man, and transfer it to the white man so that we can be better, run faster, jump higher, all of that. And that's why, another interesting part of history, that's why he told Max Schmeling, the boxer, hey, listen, when you fight Joe Louis, you are not representing Germany, because a white man can't beat a black man.
Interesting.
Yes, you can forget it. So you are not representing Germany. Do you understand? So I said, yes, I did. Now, when Schmeling beat Joe Louis the first time, oh, when he came back, oh, he was native son. He was, the king of Germany, as it were,
right,
as far as him was concerned.
Yeah, right.
You may recall that. And it was like, oh, my goodness. Of course, when he lost, then, you know, that all changed again. And Max Schmeling, incidentally, was a real nice guy. He wasn't a racist at all. In fact, he didn't even belong to the Nazi party.
Firpo, how do the blacks go from being perceived as the super soldier who require experimentation to enhance the white soldiers to being almost a non-entity, not human? How did that transition happen?
That happens the same way we find, unfortunately, police officers brutalizing and murdering black men across the country here in the United States. They are a threat.
Mm.
So, and hand-to-hand combat, if you didn't have any weapons, and you've got a group of whites and a group of blacks, then the outcome is going to be is very predictable, and that is, oh, the blacks will win. Now, all you have to do is look at, you know, most basketball teams and most football teams, you see, or boxers for the most part. So when you see that, I mean, that's clearly recognized by the powers that be, and they're thinking, oh, okay, we can't beat these guys. We can't outrun them. We can't outjump them. You know, we can't outbox them. They are a threat. So we need supplemental material in the form of arms to suppress them. So now Hitler, of course, had the same mindset. Okay, these guys are tough. You know, we can't take them one-on-one. We can't take a group of them against a group of us. So we're going to have to neutralize even the potential of a threat. And that's that was the mindset. It's just as it is today, quite frankly.
Mm.
And that's not new. So, yes, they realize that the black race is, as they would see it, interestingly enough, a superior race. But at the same time, Hitler and his followers experienced cognitive dissonance. How is it that they're this powerful, and we consider ourselves the better race?
Right.
Blonde-haired, blue-eyed, you know, so it's like, all right, in the face of the evidence here that they are more powerful, they've been the black Africans, or people of African descent all over the world, okay, they're more powerful, how is it that we are the master race? So that's why Hitler was trying to keep the purity of the race intact, because he thought that if I chase that illusory purity, then maybe we can be as good, if not better, than the black man. But of course, that was a moving target for him that he never hit.
Mm.
So that essentially, oh, the black man, at least publicly speaking, was supposed to be at the bottom of the racial ladder. But in the minds of the white supremacists there in Germany and throughout Europe, actually, it was the opposite. They knew that we have to squash these people because they truly are, at least, at the very least, physically superior to us.
What was going on with the treatment of persons of color outside of Germany?
For the most part, throughout Europe, it wasn't bad.
Okay.
You know, you had black people who were, prior to this time, in Sweden. You had them in Germany. You had them in Tudor England. You had them all over the place. In fact, you had someone who was in charge in Sweden. So many parts of Europe, China, India, we have evidence that black people were there from Africa, that the Africans were a seafaring people that traveled all over the place.
Mm.
They didn't do the same things that the Europeans did later, who came after them, and who attacked, raped, pillaged, and otherwise disseminated desecrated the holy grounds of the indigenous peoples whose lands they were visiting, decimated everything. It was just incredible, but the Africans didn't do that. We have mummies in Egypt, Africa, that have evidence, nicotine, as well as cocaine in their systems, or evidence of that in their coffins, and the only place you can get those things, you could have gotten those things at the time, was in the Americas, in North America.
Interesting.
But we have in Australia coins, you know, evidence of African coins, or I think it's the other way around, coins of that were in Australia, in Africa, in the coffins.
Mm.
Clear indications that Africans were a seafaring people long before the Europeans thought about doing that sort of thing. So, you know, you have that evidence there. So to answer your question, the rest of Europe, for the most part, they understood, hey, you know, they didn't see any big difference between black and white, except that these black people had it, had more going for them. And they didn't have an intrinsic, for the most part, racism about them, an intrinsic racial superiority. You did have some, but that was only when they realized the, once again, prowess of the black man. I'll give you a quick example as to how that is the case.
Mm-hmm.
In my travels around Europe and the world, I was in the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union. So this is prior to the fall of the Berlin Wall, so on and so forth, in 1989, okay? Now, I'm going through the Baltic states, which are Soviet satellite states at the time. When I went to one of them, I believe it was Vilnius, I was at the city there, the capital of Lithuania. I'm going about the sites and mingling with the people and so on and so forth. Well, the tour guide for one of the museums that I visited brought her son with her. Now, this little boy was about 8 years old, but she was friendly, but he would give me these dirty looks. And I'm like, man, wow, okay. Little guy, I'm not sure what's happening with him. I didn't detect racism, but he, for some reason, didn't like me.
Okay.
And that's the impression I had. And so I'm thinking, okay, next day would come. After the third day, she came to me with a smile, and she says, you know, you seem like such a nice guy. I don't think you'll be offended by what I'm going to tell you. I said, okay. She said, you may have noticed that my son has been looking askance at you, been looking at you, you know, with an evil eye, kind of. And I said, yeah, I have noticed that, now that you mentioned it. And she, then she kind of laughed, and then she said, well, here's the reason why. Every morning I make him get up, like mothers around the world do.
Okay.
Eat his breakfast, clean up his room, of course, go over his homework a little bit to keep it fresh in his mind, you know, has to take a bath, so on and so forth. Okay, all right. Well, he hates taking a bath, and I keep telling him that, you know, if you don't, you'll get sick or you'll get very dirty and you'll get sores on your skin. And what he told me was, well, look at that guy over there, meaning me. His mother didn't make him take a bath, and look, he's okay.
There are so many ways to take that.
But yeah, there are, right? So, well, and he meant it in his mind. He saw me. Now, here's what's interesting.
Yeah.
Another part of history that was similar. He saw me as a white male who just hadn't taken a bath but was doing fine.
That's how
he perceived me.
It's
an interesting. It had nothing to do with race.
Out of the mouths of 8-year-olds, right?
Absolutely. Now, that's similar to, but it was a little more on the negative side, the word Ethiopian when the Greeks were ruling the then known world. They the word Ethiopia means region of sunburnt faces.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means, region of sunburnt faces. Now, here's what happened to those white men in that portion of Africa, according to Greek mythology.
I see.
The sun, that is S-O-N, of the sun god, S-U-N, stole his father's fiery chariot and brought it too close to that part of the earth and burnt the faces of the white men who were there, so that now those faces are black and presumably ugly, as they are victims of a celestial accident.
My word. It is amazing what people do to try to minimize and to negatively grow the hatred of differences between people. I mean, it's just extraordinary.
And you know what that is? That's born from a jealousy, you know, envy, because at the same time, the Greeks were trying to imitate and emulate North Africans in the form of the Egyptians.
Let, let, I, I'd like to sort of take a turn, actually, from what we're talking about right now, to ask you how you became interested and began this pursuit yourself, just as a young one growing up. Was there a person who was particularly impactful on you as a child growing up? Why go this path?
Well, believe it or not, there wasn't anyone that I could think of who had me do this. I'm the only one in my family who has done something like this among my relatives or my friends. I was, as a little boy, just a naive little guy, totally oblivious to things happening around me. I was raised in a religious household to think that believe that all people are equal, they're the same. I didn't even know what racism was. Discrimination was.
You know now.
I'm from South Central LA, you know.
Yeah.
My father was a Baptist preacher, and get this, my mother was one of Jehovah's Witnesses, and we were just taught, hey, listen, everybody's the same, you know, let's just do our thing, and I'm just having a ball. Yes, I lived through the Watts, as they called it at the time, riot of 1965, and then the rebellion in 1992 in connection with what happened with Rodney King. So now I'm beginning to wake up now.
Okay.
I'm beginning to wake up. I have this strong biblical background. To this day, I teach comparative religion on a university level,
okay.
And I am a scholar of the Bible. But I'm just thinking, okay, everything's cool, but now, slowly but surely, I'm beginning to realize what we call black history, but what is in reality history. And as I'm waking up and getting, you know, more conscious, I'm like, wow, man, this is too much. This is incredible. This cannot be. Why didn't anyone tell me this? Why aren't we being taught these things in school? And then, of course, I began to recognize black leaders more closely, recognize them and then study them more closely in the case of Malcolm, Martin, but particularly Malcolm X. Now, the reason why he intrigued me was that his mother also had dealings with Jehovah's Witnesses.
Okay.
So I'm thinking, oh, okay, that's interesting. And he's read the Bible, and he credits them with getting him to read as he did, although the movie might show otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, oh yeah, they taught us to read and do all of that, and they taught us people skills. That is, we're going on knocking on people's doors, and we don't know what the reaction is going to be or what objection is going to be brought about when the door opens, but we have to be ready for everything. So I'm thinking, oh, okay, that's interesting. But Malcolm enjoyed the meetings, as did his mother especially. And so I said, well, let me do what he did as I got older. Let me read the dictionary. Of course, everything's fine, but I'm at a point in my life right now where I have some time, so I'm going to read the dictionary. I read the dictionary, and, you know, because of Malcolm's example, he's the one now that I'm emulating. I was blown away that it's as racist as it's ever been, and as a result of that, prior to writing Germany's Black Holocaust, 1890 to 1945, I wrote the book Wicked Words, Poisoned Minds, Racism in the Dictionary. And because, unlike Malcolm, of course, he gave me the seminal idea. I not only read the dictionary from cover to cover and noticed all these racist words, I decided to document them.
All right, let me have the name of that book again. What's the name
of the book? Sure. Wicked Words,
mm-hmm.
Poisoned Minds, Racism in the Dictionary. It's
all
also
right.
Another bestseller of mine, and of course you can get it on Amazon, but all you have to do is type in Wicked Words, Poisoned Minds, and it'll come right up. It's done very well over the years, as you can imagine, and I've revised it several times. I'll give an example. And Dr. Brewer, you know, you probably should be sitting down when I tell you this.
Okay, I'll sit down.
Okay.
I'm ready.
All right. As I read Merriam-Webster's dictionary, I ran across the word gorilla, the animal. So I thought, okay, what's the big deal? We know what a gorilla is. I'll just go ahead and read it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the etymology of the word. It is a Greek word. We talked about the Greeks before. It's a Greek word. This is verbatim. Believed to be the name of an alleged tribe of hairy African women.
Wow.
That's what we get.
Okay, you told me to sit down. You didn't tell me that I needed to lay down.
Lay down. And you know, it's there right now. Believed to be the name of an alleged African tribe of hairy women. Those are the exact words. Anyway, I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
That can't be true. And sure enough, it's there. And all anyone has to do, any of your listeners, they can go online. They can Google the etymology of gorilla or where the word gorilla came from, and you'll see it. So I'm thinking, oh, no, that's probably an exception. Let me just keep reading the dictionary. You know. Now, here's something else. Calipygian is a word I ran across earlier. Calipygian, spelled Calipygia.
Okay.
That's what it means. Having shapely buttocks. Or having beautiful buttocks. I'm like, oh, okay. I laugh, you know.
There's a word for everything, right?
I know what line I'm going to use on the next sister I meet, you know, that has this. Hey, baby, you're Calipygius, you know. But, you know, so I had these little, you know, light things going through my mind until I ran across the word steatopygia, which is related. Both are Greek words.
Okay.
Steatopygia, Steatopygia, steatopygia. That let me know that Calipygia is a racist word. Now, against black women.
How so?
Now, why do I say that?
Yes.
And once again, here's what's startling about all of this information. And, of course, what's also very good about this information is that all of it can be verified by simply Googling these words.
Yeah.
Now, here we go. Steatopygia means having an excessive amount of fat on the buttocks, especially in African women. Black women. So Calipygian, which is related to calligraphy, which means beautiful handwriting, Calipygia's beautiful buttocks, that's for the white woman, although it doesn't say it in the dictionary. It took extra research to find that out.
I see.
And what I found was you have what they call Venus of the Calipygia. And if you put that in and click on images in Google, you will see statuettes, which there are plenty of them that they have discovered, of a white woman turning around, looking at her buttocks, the reflection of her buttocks in a pond of water. And of course, she's white. Now, for the black woman, the African woman, it was an excessive amount of fat on the buttocks, two different Greek words.
Mm-hmm.
And steatopygia was not applied to white women, and Calipygia was not applied to black women. And once again, gorilla is applied to black women. So the dictionary rips the black woman apart, just like it does the black man and child.
You know, Firpo, as we're talking about this, your awakening, so to speak, and reading things that are right in front of you, the dictionary, the lot of the resources that you cite in your book, you can find them everywhere, anywhere. And, you know, for a moment, it can feel actually overwhelming that there is so much animosity and fear towards persons of color. Do you ever find yourself just wanting to take a break from all of this reality?
That's a very good question, and thank you for asking it, Pam. I have asked myself that question until, but it's only a fleeting for a fleeting moment, or I have asked myself that question from time to time, even more so recently, quite honestly, although it's fleeting, as I stated now. Why is that? Because my people, as well as other people, other members of the human family, they're all ignorant of this for the most part.
Mm.
It's hidden. So now I feel it incumbent upon me to share it. And so I put myself, my own frailties and foibles to the side and say, oh, okay, I have a message that I have to get out now. All of my books are self-published. I can name a very, Simon & Schuster, a very popular publishing house, who was fascinated by Wicked Words, Poison Minds, Racism in the Dictionary, that book. But when they saw it and read it, they decided, we can't publish this. Now, they hounded me before, and they found out about me. I didn't go looking for them. They found out about the book and tracked me down and said, we want to publish it, we want to publish it. Please FedEx it to us. So I did. Then I didn't hear from them for a day or two. When I contacted them, I said, hey, what's going on? You guys were blowing up my phone, and now all of a sudden, I hear crickets. Well, what's happening? And they said, hey, listen, we read your book. It's fascinating. It's remarkable. We didn't even know it. But we can't publish it because we publish dictionaries. And you've just exposed the dictionary as a racist book.
Yeah, that would sort of take them out of the running for publishing it.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm like, okay. Now, it reminds me of something I heard and that you've heard, no doubt, and that is if you want to hide something from a, we'll say, person of color, a black person, put it in a book. Now, I don't really have a problem with that because that's now incumbent upon the black man, woman, or child to read the book.
Okay,
if you know the truth or a secret is in a book and the book is right there, well, then go and read the book. Now, here's where I have a problem with, if you will, the white man. Here's the problem I have with the racist white man, and that is this. If I write the book, you go take it upon yourself to hide the book. So it's not just hiding information in a book. That's on me if I don't pick up the book or purchase the book. But now if you're going to hide the book, then I have a problem with you. And that's what has happened here. That's why all of this is shocking probably to your listeners, and because they have, in effect, tried to hide my books and some others. I'm not the only one, but these books are startling, and I must say that my book, probably, or my books that I've mentioned here, are the only ones of their kind. You won't find another book where the person has read the dictionary and extracted most of the racist words and given a history of those racist words and examples of how they've been used and how those words are still in the dictionary. You're not going to find that anywhere else. So, if it were some other book, I'd probably get a Nobel Prize.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
No, we don't want any, uppity Negroes around, as they would see it, exposing this information. So
you're absolutely right.
Yes.
So let's now go back to Germany's Black Holocaust. Certainly the book is well documented. There are tons of photographs. There are tons of references. Let's kind of talk about the kinds of things that the Black Africans were exposed to. We know that they were doing experiments at one point to enhance the white folks. You heard me make reference to the lampshade. What were some of the other things that were happening to black persons during the Holocaust?
Okay, we probably would have to delineate between which Holocaust, because, of course, the lampshades came later, for the most part, during World War II. But you didn't have those, from any documentation I've read, during the first Holocaust, prior to World War I. But to answer your question, I'll try to give you a bird's-eye view of what the black interaction, if you will, with their tormentors in both eras or both time periods.
Okay.
the first time period, Holocaust One, we'll call it, just like they call it World War One and World War Two. I'll mm-hmm. call it Holocaust One. Again, it was Africans. Well, they were not only very angry. Well, I should mention this first. The motivation. Okay, it's one thing because you had other European powers who had their own colonies there, but like the French, they didn't do the same thing that the Germans did. Yes, the Belgians, they were horrible, and we already know that story about what they did in the Congo, but what about the Germans? The Belgians didn't experiment en masse against black Africans, but the Germans did. So what's the motivation?
Right.
Well, the motivation was the Herero and the Nama, the other ethnic groups there, some of them rebelled against the Germans.
Okay.
They're like, oh, wait a minute, we're not gonna take this. I mean, well, yeah, we thought that you guys were cool at first, but now you are taking our women, you know, and what have you, and mistreating them and mistreating us, and now you're taking our land. Oh, no, we can't have this.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the Malcolm X's or the Huey Newtons or the you know, Martin Luther King's among those people who stood up against them in various ways and, of course, in violent ways because they met violence with violence. The Germans thinking, how dare these backwards people raise up against us and win certain skirmishes? Okay, now we're going to teach them a lesson, and we're going to squash them. Familiar theme, isn't it?
It is indeed. It is much too familiar and much too current.
Indeed. So that was the motivation there, because it's like, oh, no, the Africans said, you've crossed the line now. Yeah, we know about the others. And what it did, and this is what really exacerbated things as far as the Germans were concerned, it united these former enemy ethnic groups.
Okay.
You know, they're like, oh, okay, wait a minute, we have a common enemy now. No, I don't like what you did to me, you know, our peoples, our tribes, if you will, and I don't like what you did to, you know, what you did to me, and you don't like what I did to you, and so on and so forth. But, hey, this white man, look at what he's doing to all of us. He just sees us as one and the same, pretty much. And he's mistreating all of us. So they all got together and formed a confederacy to fight against the Germans. But the Germans with their guns and what have you, and their, at that time, more modern weaponry and dirty tactics and what have you, they just went in to crush them. And so as they actually defeated the local tribes or groups, then they wanted to teach them a lesson. They would starve them.
And
that's why in the front of my book, Germany's Black Holocaust, you see an actual photograph of a concentration camp where a family of black Africans are emaciated.
Absolutely.
So you see that. You're normally used to seeing Jews looking that way,
right,
with their uniforms on during World War II, but they didn't have uniforms then. They didn't give them clothes. So you see these basically naked Africans on the front cover of my book,
right?
Skin and bones, because they're being starved. And it's a photograph, not a drawing or anything, of this family, skin and bones, black family Africans in a concentration camp there in the early 20th century, around 1904, 1905, 1906, around that time, because the Germans were very upset that these black Africans would dare rise up against them, cause an uprising. They should just be the victims and let us take their land and their women and beat their men and just take over things. And, of course, echoes of that is happening, you know, are happening right now in Africa,
yeah,
are being felt in Africa, I should say, you know, with certain African leaders saying, okay, we're going to take all the land from white people and kick them out or what have you. I don't have to mention the country or the names, but that's what that's all about, you'd say. So anyway, although that's not specifically in Namibia, which is the former German Southwest African colony, but that same mindset is around there. But getting back to your question as to what other things the blacks were doing, mm-hmm. or how they were responding to their tormentors and invaders and what have you. They
did that and what the ways. Germans were doing to them.
Say that again, I'm sorry?
I said, and what the Germans were doing to them, to the blacks.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yes, they were, that was it, raping and pillaging, taking the women. In fact, it's amazing to see that they pretty much broke the will of certain ones. So the women, you know, they were at the disposal of the German men. The German men did, as I stated before, they would torment and torture the ones they found who were the ringleaders, and they would brutalize them, beat them, and kill them, murder them in mass. You know, thousands, some say millions. And also they would starve them to death. They wanted to see what would happen. They would decapitate, which you'll see a photograph in my book, the young ones, the mm-hmm. young boys, to see, as it were, what they're made of. How can we study them? And this is colonial Germany.
Literally.
Hitler's just a little baby, a little child. Yeah. So we're not talking about Nazi Germany. We're talking about colonial Germany. And Fischer, Ornigen Fischer, is one of the doctors. They calmly, methodically experimented on them. Young man, woman, and child, African. And so that's what they were doing. And it pushed, as I mentioned, some of the African leaders to the point where, okay, we're going to die anyway. You know, these guys are doing this, so we have to rise up and fight. We're not going to go down without a battle. We're going to join forces. Similar to some saying today, some young black man, a black man, are being told, carry a gun because the cops are going to shoot you there. You're unarmed, whether you're armed or not.
Right.
You know, you're going to die, so you might as well go down with a blaze of bullets. That's what some are advocating. I'm not advocating that, but it's the same mindset. You know, and so when you look at that, when you see that, it's like, oh, man, this isn't new. It's the same thing being repeated, you know.
So let me ask you this. We're talking about horrifying events across in history, horrifying events, many of which are unknown to, if not most people, certainly many people. And here we are today, and we're drawing analogies between what happened then, and we're going back to the 1890s, and what's happening now. What is the point of doing that? Is there any value to looking at this history, this horrifying history, and talking about it today?
Absolutely, to show that history is circular or cyclical. It's repeating itself, and that, unfortunately, it's not getting better. It is not. It's getting worse, unfortunately, in this 21st century. We're now, and, you know, we're talking about the end of the 19th century, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century, and now the beginning of the 21st century. It's the same thing. Technology, advances in technology and in science, have not impeded the progress of white supremacy. You know, that's just a reality. That's the value of it. So if we know that, then what can we do about it? How can we arm ourselves, especially intellectually?
Well, that's an excellent question. How do we arm ourselves?
The march is still going on.
Yeah.
Okay, so, no, don't fool yourself into this this whole idea about, what is it, post-racialism or racism?
Right.
No, forget that. That's not happening at all.
Okay.
Let me mention something to you. While Hitler was experimenting on black men to improve his soldiers, you know, the whole idea of that thing that I went over, improve those soldiers, make them better, his white soldiers, so they can go back in and take those colonies that they had before. While he was experimenting on black men, Hitler, Nazi scientists, were communicating with white doctors in America who were experimenting on the Tuskegee, men of Tuskegee. they were collaborating. So you had both people, nations on both sides of the Atlantic, the Germans on the one side and the Americans on the other side, both experimenting on black men.
So
stunning.
It is stunning, and again, I have to ask, this is so powerful to look at the length of the history and the consistency of the behavior and the consistency of the hatred. That again, I say, how do we in today's world remain positive? Do we remain positive? Is that just a pipe dream? I mean, does everybody just run out and expect that it's all going to go up in a burst of flames? I mean, how do we move forward? For the people who are listening to our conversation right now, at the end of this conversation, I know they're exhausted. I know they're exhausted. How do they, with their exhaustion, turn to tomorrow with a sense of purpose and hope, or do they?
Absolutely. But before I answer that question or address those questions, I let me finish telling you. that was then. That was World War II. We move forward, and then we have blacks being experimented on at John Hopkins Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's like, on my website, I have an article there. Horrible Hopkins Hospital is a quote where they were experimenting on black people there in black Baltimore. Since no one was keeping count, as it were, they would experiment on them, then say that they were crazy, send them to the asylum, and then experiment, kill them, and bury them in a black black graveyard. All right, so that, then you had that going on. And then most recently you have the CDC experimenting on others. Down in South America, also doing certain things to blacks here. That last month, when it came out.
You are not helping me to feel better, okay?
I wish I could. Oh, I will after I finish telling you these stories, okay?
Okay.
All right, now here's the better feel, and this is why I anticipated your question, Pamela, and that's why I mentioned that my parents raised me in a religious household.
Okay.
All right. I knew you were going to ask that question. Okay. The only hope we have is divine intervention as I see it. As corny as that may sound to people, and for those who are saying, well, wait a minute, our ancestors, our forefathers here in America, they were slaves and they gave them Christianity, this white man's religion, so on and so forth. The fact of the matter is that even though they slaughtered millions of us, we're still here. We survived.
Mm.
Now, the way I was taught was that humanity cannot govern itself. We're incapable of doing that. And that's why the whole world is getting worse, not just black people in America. And the white oppressors are also suffering. Well, how is that? The same way that white guards in prisons suffer and have to go to prison every day for 8 hours a day to deal with individuals who are locked there 24 hours a day. The guards are as much prisoners as the inmates, as it were.
Okay.
So it's like, okay. So everyone, whether we realize it or not, is suffering. If I'm the white man and I'm in charge, that means I have to watch my back 24/7.
That's true.
And I have to figure out a way how I'm going to get rid of all of these millions of black people or people of color all over the world, or at least to control them. Okay, that's leading me to a premature grave. And interestingly enough, the Bible says man has dominated man to his injury in Ecclesiastes, which suggests to me that, it doesn't matter if you're in that equation, whether you're whether you are the dominator or dominatee, if you will, you are not in a good position. And plus, in our minds, we're not equipped to do that sort of thing. So to bring this full circle, in that same book, I think God has, I know God has given us the answer, and he's given us the answer in the most popular book in history, so that anyone can read it and say, guess what? You can't govern yourselves as humans. I didn't download that program into your psyche.
Mm.
And I need you to realize that. Now, I'm going to undo all of this. But I want you to understand that you can't do this, even though you said you could through your foreparents, Adam and Eve, who felt that they could rule themselves without God. Well, no, that's not possible. So I wanted to give you adequate time to prove to yourselves that you will make a mess of things. And that's precisely what we have done. Now, he also said that I have a time limit. The time for you to do this has an expiration date. What that date is, you won't know. You don't need to know. But there will be an expiration date. And once again, I'll undo the badness that you've done. The only thing that's going to make us feel good is the same thing that got our forefathers and foremothers through slavery, who lived to a ripe old age and died under an oppressive government and system, you know, where systemic racism is strong as ever now.
Mm-hmm.
It got them through. They're okay. And that's what's getting me through. My faith in God, my faith in the Bible.
Okay.
And that's what's going to still, it worked. It's time tested. It works. So when your brother or my brother or our fathers, brothers, uncles, cousins, when they're shot down by the police, okay, well, I look at things. Well, first of all, I think, okay, when you're shot down and killed, that it's been scientifically proven in a very odd sort of way that the resurrection is possible. Now, let me say this. Let me explain that. Right now, scientists don't know why we die. They know what happens.
Okay.
But they don't know why. Old age itself is a disease, as can be proven by something they call progeria, P-R-O-G-E-R-I-A. Now, you may have seen victims of this because it manifests itself, that is old age, in young children, 8, 9, 10 years old.
Yes.
They're gray and old and decrepit at 8, 9, and 10 years
mm-hmm.
old. That's called progeria. That proves to scientists that the aging process is a disease that can be remedied. And that's why they're trying to find ways to remedy the disease, whether it's through cryogenics or cryobiology, that is freezing individuals until they come up with a cure to resuscitate them and then apply the cure to them so that they can live forever.
Right.
We're talking science here. We're not talking hocus pocus. You can put the Bible aside if you like. That's what scientists realize. There is no reason why we should die. When you went to bed last night, or any of us, we wake up the next morning, our bodies have done its job. Our body has done its job. Your body did its job and mine. That's why when we have to get up, the waste products have been pushed up or pushed out. That's why we all have to urinate when we get up in the morning. That's why we have matter in our eyes, because whatever eyelashes didn't block out, our eyes will cleanse themselves while we sleep, and that's why we have matter on either end.
Mm-hmm.
That's why our breath isn't the freshest, because whatever waste products didn't go down through our intestines is pushed up. So our bodies are trying to live, you see. All of a sudden, when we get a certain age, they start to break down. When I look at the Bible and see that, you can live forever, I see the scientific proof of that. And instead of calling it resuscitation, in the case of cryogenics, we'll say, when they want to reanimate or resuscitate the frozen body and give it life again,
mm-hmm.
the most word for it is resurrect. So they're flip sides of the same coin, science and the Bible. Not necessarily science and religion, because some religions misrepresent the Bible.
Okay, fair enough.
Science and the Bible are going in the same direction. So the hope I have is that, this madness that we are experiencing does have an expiration date. And it will end soon. And once it ends, then all that has happened that has been bad insofar as the human race is concerned, will be undone.
Good thing. And we will have you back very soon.
Look forward to it. Thank you for having me.
All righty. And folks, thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. You can also listen to Mind Talk on demand at myndtalk.org. My guess is that today's conversation is one that you will want to go back to repeatedly. The managing producer is Jim Brown, and 26 by 2 Communications for Mind Talk with Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. Again, for more information, please go to mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org. And please always, always remember, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.